What's exposing my genitals? Oh, no, no, no. I got to stop myself on that one. Sophie's not here. Cody and Katie are, and hey. I am ashamed that I even tried that one. In my defense, we were talking about chat roulette.
It's true. Yeah. The whole context of that joke makes it better.
It does.
That we were just talking about, because then you just let it fly real quick.
But we will not be informing the listeners of the context.
No.
But I will inform them that my co-hosts today are Katie Stoll, Cody Johnson.
Hi.
Hello.
Some news and even more news.
That's correct.
Even more news.
Of it. Some more of it. Even more of it.
Network.com integer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were really creative when we thought of these names.
Yes, we are all creative geniuses.
Well, if you have a show and you're like, I want to do that, but more of it.
Humble, also. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Humble, creative geniuses. Mm-hmm. Humble, sexy, creative geniuses.
Humble, sexy, unstoppable, creative geniuses.
Unstoppable, yeah, yeah.
Powerful.
Mm-hmm. We should probably add a second humble in there, too. I mean, what we really are is news grifters. But today we're talking about a less ethical kind of grifter.
Oh. Great.
Free speech grifters.
Yes.
But free speech is important, Robert.
Oh, it is. You and know. Also, this is Behind the Bastards, the podcast where I talk about the worst people in all of history and forget to announce things because I'm hanging out with my buds and not doing my job.
We're not doing work.
Again, Sophie is not here, which is why I have a podcasting machete.
He Sophie really does.
Does yeah. not let me bring my 18-inch long machete, but I have it.
Yep. They let you fly with
it? It is in your hand.
Oh, yeah. You can fly with machetes. You can fly with all. You can fly with, God, fly with guns before. It's
I want
easy.
You all know yeah. he's gesturing with it. And I yeah. said, when he said, oh, yeah, you can fly with machetes, he pointed it right at me. Mm-hmm.
Well, you're a good 2-3 feet away.
It's true.
Yeah.
Like, I don't
if
feel
I need
threatened.
This paper.
Boom. Yeah, it's just, it's gesturing, it's a tool. I wouldn't describe it as wildly brandishing your machete.
No, because I have not started drinking.
Exactly.
When I will be drinking is when we do our election year podcast.
That's right.
And then I will be drunkenly gesturing with machete, perhaps at CPAC?
Maybe, definitely at CPAC.
Maybe, definitely at CPAC.
That's going to be an exciting time.
You get your
time.
Machete, I got my lanyard, we're going to have a
And I've
time.
Got my phone to record it all. Mm-hmm.
Yep, yeah, we can name the video Machanyard.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should probably get into content that will be enjoyable for people who aren't the three of us.
If you're not interested in the Machanyard podcast, then okay.
Okay. How are you guys doing?
Good.
I didn't ask
good.
You that on this.
Thank you.
We've been talking for hours already.
It's true, yeah.
We have.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have.
Good, good.
Good.
We're good. Mm. We're well.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Well, I'm gonna get into this. Now,
yes.
This is not focused around a person, which is my norm, but it's focused around some people, and I think folks will find it
Plural,
interesting.
Bastards.
Bastards. Yeah. Over the last few years, particularly since 2016, the cause of free speech has become one of the most vicious and blood-soaked battlegrounds in our national culture war. It's a unique one, too, because while most of America's political kerfuffles revolve around issues like abortion or gun rights, where there really is little common ground, free speech is a thing that everyone, at least in theory, supports.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's weird.
I'd say,
I would say,
yeah.
I agree with that.
Big fan, big Fran. Love speaking freely.
Yeah. Big Fran, yeah.
Big Fran. Love shouting freely.
Big Fran over here with her shouting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Big Fran loves to shout.
Big Fran, BF. Mm. Now, in August 3rd, 2018, famous tabloid The New York Post published an article titled How Liberals Turned Against Free Speech.
Mm.
It opens with this line. Why is it considered liberal to compel others to say or fund things they don't believe? That's a question raised by 3 Supreme Court decisions this year, and it's a puzzling development for those of us old enough to remember when liberals championed free speech, even advocacy of sedition, and conservatives wanted government to restrain or limit it. So, that's the opening of the article. And the 3 cases were, 2 of them were one California case overturning a statute that required anti-abortion pregnancy centers to inform clients of where they could obtain abortions, and the reversal of a 41-year-old precedent which stated that public employees didn't have to pay union fees to cover the cost of collective bargaining. And the 3rd was one of those stupid fucking cases about a Christian bakery not wanting to make cakes for gay people.
Classic. So, at least one a year.
All of these stories confuse me as to how, like, that abortion thing, what about that's free speech? Like, not informing. Anyway, continue.
That's a great question, Katie. That's a great question. I'm gonna dig into that one a little bit in specific. But I do want to note that the Post article quotes Neil Ferguson, who argues that liberals are increasingly authoritarian. And it ends on this line. like the liberal Supreme Court justices who see no constitutional problem with compelling crisis pregnancy centers to send messages they find repugnant, or requiring union members to subsidize political speech they disagree with, or forcing people to participate in ceremonies prohibited by their religion, they seem not to have noticed Yale law professor Stephen Carter's observation that every law is violent because behind every exercise of law stands the sheriff. Carter calls for a degree of humility in passing and enforcing laws that compel speech against conscience, something today's liberals seem to have forgotten. Liberals is in quotation marks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, you got to get those scare quotes in.
Yeah, got to get those fucking square quotes in. Yeah, so it's easy to see. I can see how someone might be convinced by that line of reasoning. Like, if someone believes abortion is wrong and they open a clinic to help pregnant women in crisis, it's good to help pregnant women in crisis. And people who think abortion is wrong shouldn't be required to push people towards abortion doctors. That's an argument you could make, and it's an argument that if you have exactly that much evidence available to you, there's logic to it.
Yeah, yeah, on the surface, that makes sense.
Yeah. Now, when you read a little bit more into these centers, it becomes easier to see the authoritarian liberal argument as to why that maybe doesn't include all of the relevant facts. I'm going to quote from a report by the AMA, famed liberal lobbying group, All of the Doctors. Drive down any highway in America and you might see a sign. Pregnant, scared, called 1-800-5, you know, phone number. Most often these signs are advertisements for crisis pregnancy centers, CPCs. CPCs, sometimes known as pregnancy resource centers, pregnancy care centers, pregnancy support centers, or simply pregnancy centers, are organizations that seek to intercept women with unintended or crisis pregnancies who might be considering abortion. And then, a little further down, it notes, CPCs, as a rule, not only discourage abortion, but also refuse to provide referrals to abortion clinics, although they often provide counseling about dangers associated with premarital sexual activity. Women who visit CPCs typically do not realize that they are not in an abortion clinic and are surprised to find that abortion is not considered an option at these centers. As obstetrician-gynecologists, we have had several disgruntled patients come to us who were disappointed and felt deceived by the care that they had received at CPCs. So you see, it's not quite as simple as these do-gooders being forced to speak against their will. It's somebody dressing up a religious mission as a medical.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Cool.
So, if you're pregnant and you go there and you feel like you're in crisis and you're pregnant, one of their solutions is to teach about the dangers of
premarital sex.
Premarital sex.
Yeah.
Like, is that effective? That ship's to the pregnant already sailed. Woman?
Well, it's kind of like if you go into the doctor with lung cancer after a life of smoking, the doctors will say, well, have you tried not fucking smoking?
You know, smoking's bad for you.
Yeah, you know, cigarettes aren't good for you.
Let me put on this film strip real quick about how smoking is bad.
Not doing you no favors.
Mm, I love doctors that are helpful.
Yeah. There's a lollipop on your way.
Yeah,
no, that specific story bugs me.
Yeah, it's frustrating. That's why that's the one I chose to focus on. Because it frustrated me, too. If you read into it a little bit, it becomes clear that despite how it was framed by the New York Post, this is not a pro or anti-free speech argument. Instead, it's an argument over whether or not religious organizations should be allowed to masquerade fraudulently as medical practitioners and lie about healthcare options, which is maybe a little different than
free speech.
Seems
a little different. Seems like not quite the free speech issue.
Just a smidge, maybe.
Mumble, mumble.
Now, the fight over crisis pregnancy counseling centers is emblematic of the broader debate over free speech currently consuming our national discourse. Take a serious political issue that has nothing to do with the First Amendment, wrap it in that cloak, and tar the other side for being anti-free speech so they have to defend themselves on that front rather than actually debate you over the harms of what you're doing. It's a cool strategy.
Yeah.
Smart.
Yeah. Works.
It's like if you're hunting a deer, instead of camouflaging yourself, you dress yourself up as another deer, but with a gun for a mouth.
Oh, yeah.
This may not, in fact, be an analogy.
It's perfect. Then you got to argue with that gun-mouthed deer, right? Yeah. Instead of, well, you're clearly a hunter and you're not a gun-mouthed deer, but now I want to debate that gun-mouthed deer.
Well, and you know that old chestnut of country wisdom. Nobody ever wins a debate with a gun-mouthed deer.
Well, you can't because as soon as he tries to talk, a bullet shoots out of his mouth.
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
Hey, that's a good argument from the gun-mouthed deer.
Thank you for embracing my... I still don't think it's an analogy.
Your perfect analogy?
My perfect analogy.
I've definitely lost the thread, but I'm on board.
Thank you. Thank you. Also, just full disclosure, I mix up analogies and similes constantly.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. Metaphors, all of it.
Metaphors. Oh, my God. Participles. Yeah. Dangling.
Those aren't related at all.
No. Mm. No, they're not. But it makes me uncomfortable to think about things dangling.
Yeah.
That's true.
Particularly participles. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, the free speech grift, as it's been coined by some critics, has risen to become the centerpiece of right-wing politics because it is so much easier than actually arguing the merits of regressive policies on abortion, racial justice, or anything else. It is a brilliant strategy because it allows them to co-opt the support of a sizable number of moderates and liberals who are either too dumb to see what's happening or who are eager to capitalize on the grift themselves. In fact, the origins of our modern free speech grift trace back to a 2015 article in The Atlantic titled "The Coddling of the American Mind." Yeah, you like that?
Yes, I love these.
Yeah, you're almost touching your nipples, Cody.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Yeah. Now, the article written by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt, and the thrust of it is that political correctness has completely overtaken American campuses, ushering in a terrifying new era where art is censored and language is destroyed to please howling hordes of liberal zombies.
God, they're so obsessed with these college campuses.
They are. Yes. Big fans of college campuses.
You know how, like, college, this is where, like, you learn and, like, you do some dumb stuff and, like, maybe you make things out to be more than they are and then you sort of grow out of it and then, like, you go enter the world.
Yeah, maybe you you put cocaine up your butt a couple of times, you realize maybe. That's not good, and then you go into the world and you snort cocaine like an adult.
My point
is... that's how it's done.
That's how it's done.
This is the one problem facing America today.
Yes.
That's what I was getting at.
College campuses.
College campuses, yeah.
And PC culture.
Mm-hmm. And PC culture.
You know, let's not try to be courteous and empathetic to other people. Let's not try to listen to other people and their perspectives.
No.
Let's just fuck them.
Because it's violence to me if you say, that kind of made me feel bad.
Yeah.
I'm deeply
offended.
Whoa.
I'm deeply offended that I offended you.
Yeah. I'm going to quote from the article. For example, some students have called for warnings that Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart describes racial violence and that F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby portrays misogyny and physical abuse so that students who have been previously victimized by racism or domestic violence can choose to avoid these works, which they believe might trigger a recurrence of past trauma. Some recent campus actions border on the surreal. In April, at Brandeis University, the Asian American Student Association sought to raise awareness of microaggressions against Asians through an installation on the steps of an academic hall. The installation gave examples of microaggressions, such as, "Aren't you supposed to be good at math?" and "I'm colorblind, I don't see race." But a backlash arose among other Asian American students who felt that the display itself was a microaggression. The association removed the installation, and its president wrote an email to the entire student body apologizing to anyone who was triggered or hurt by the content of the microaggressions. So that's what they're complaining about, is the coddling of the American mind.
Yeah.
Like that sort of stuff. Okay.
That one small story has changed my mind
about this issue.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's what they do in the article, is they pick out a couple of stories where it's pretty easy. Okay, yeah, that's a group of people maybe behaving in a way that I would consider a little bit unreasonable, or like that's it, or at least the way that it's characterized makes it seems like they might be a little unreasonable. But it's not, interestingly enough, for logic ration people like the folks who tend to be on this grift, it doesn't delve much into actual. I just tapped my papers on the table for influence. Statistics to tell us maybe if this is a broad problem or not.
That information is available.
I wonder if that information is available. It is!
And you have it right here?
I do have it right here, courtesy of, I didn't do the research myself, being a hack and a fraud, but I did find the research done by the Niskanen Center, a nonpartisan think tank dedicated to fostering an open society. They collected data from a number of studies on the beliefs of the I generation, a.k.a. Generation Z, a.k.a. the kids who are in high school and college currently.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it turns out these kids are less likely to strongly favor free speech bans than any other age group.
Mm.
So actually, kids in college right now are the least likely to support any restrictions on freedom of speech.
Interesting.
Quote. A decade of data from the Knight Foundation on high school students tells a similar story. Support for the First Amendment is currently at its strongest level yet recorded, with a majority of high schoolers, 56%, disagreeing with the statement, "The First Amendment goes too far in the rights it protects." Note that there is no change during the years when Ijen would be entering high school. And contrary to Haidt's theory about the relationship between social media and free speech, the Knight Foundation survey also found that high schoolers who actively engage with news on social media, discussing stories, posting comments, and linking to articles, consistently demonstrate greater support for free speech. Not less.
Interesting. Huh. So maybe taking isolated incidents that are sort of like charged with emotion.
Yeah, of the thousands and thousands of campuses in the country and hundreds of thousands of students.
And then pinpointing and saying like, this is a nationwide problem. This is every college. This is all of
maybe
them.
Maybe that's not scientific.
Yeah, maybe it's complete nonsense.
Maybe it's intellectually dim.
Yeah, maybe it's just lying. Can we say lying on a podcast?
I think we can.
Well, you can bleep it.
We can bleep it. You know, you know, I'm going to make a bleeping noise by hitting this empty LaCroix can with a machete, and we can just put that in a post. This is a good idea. Don't worry, it's fine. Can we? We'll post that. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Everybody good?
It's the best bleep I've ever heard.
Thank you. Okay.
And now you've got a place to put your knife.
I know. Now it's nice. Oh, yeah, it's perfect. A nice little machete holder. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made a little pocket for it.
Yeah. Everything works out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that about the world. Now, the Niskanen Center summary also notes that in a later article, Haight and another writer cite that 2017 Knight Foundation study that was just quoted above to make the same point, noting a rise in the number of college students who say, the climate on my campus prevents some people from saying things they believe because others might find them offensive. The rise is from 54% in 2016 to 61% in 2017. But Haight and his co-author neglect to mention that 2016 and 2017 are the only years for which data on that question is available, making it essentially meaningless as a way to identify a trend. They also insinuate that this increase in censorship is driven by liberal and leftist students. However, quote, this increase is being driven by perceptions of self-censorship among Democrats and independents. The number of Republican students who reported a censorious climate on campus actually dropped from 62% to 53%.
That's wild.
Cool.
you love to laugh.
You love intellectual
you gotta laugh.
Honesty.
Yeah. This is wholly unsurprising. I don't think I've seen this data you're referring to. I saw a similar report about this. And
there's
how
actually quite a lot of data on
this. There's a lot of data on it, yeah. Basically, saying the same thing, that like the perception is actually the opposite of reality.
Yeah.
And this is like, you can see this kind of generally throughout history of like, a lot of the left gets censored.
People who actually want society to change in massive fundamental ways often censor themselves.
Often.
Right.
And even just like professors, like left-wing professors get censored a lot more than any of these people. And
we'll get into that.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, that Niskanen study does also note that according to a 2017 YouGov study, conservative students were more likely to report censoring themselves in the classroom, 60% versus 53%, and outside of it, 47% versus 40%. But even this data does not tell the entire story. A survey conducted by Cato and YouGov notes that 58% of Americans nationwide report self-censoring their views among other people. Conservative college students are actually less likely to report censoring themselves than conservative Americans outside of colleges, and liberals on college campuses censor themselves more often than liberals in the general population.
So are you suggesting that it's the opposite again?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Maybe a little bit the opposite.
Okay. I'm just clarifying. I'm just clarifying.
Thank you for clarity is important.
Again, wholly unsurprising.
Yeah. So in other words, the entire story of free speech suppression on American college campuses is a lie. The reality is literally the opposite. Yet in spite of this, right-wing groups like Turning Point USA.
Hooray!
Cody's favorite.
My favorite fellows.
Yeah. Have raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to influence political elections on college campuses and crusade against safe spaces at their campus clash events. Their 2019 tour includes speakers like TPUSA founder Charlie Kirk, Donald Trump Jr., Candace Owens, and Kyle Kashuv, who recently got his Harvard invitation rescinded for writing racial slurs in several text messages to classmates in an open Google Doc. Cool.
Are you suggesting that the president's son is being censored?
Oh, yeah. That poor guy never
gets
to speak.
You're saying that the president's son has a free speech problem?
It must suck to be the president's son and to be so rich. Mm-hmm.
It's a maybe shame when millionaires funded by billionaires just say lies.
and someone gets angry at them.
Someone gets angry.
And that is the death of free speech. Mm-hmm. Someone getting angry at a millionaire being paid by billionaires to lie. Lying.
That's censorship.
It's
criticism
oppression.
Is censorship.
It's oppression, guys. Call it what it is. Yeah.
I should also note that free speech bastion TPUSA donors include such luminaries as Greg Gianforte, who assaulted a Guardian journalist for asking him questions.
Yes,
I didn't know Greg was involved with TPUSA.
Oh, he sure is. He's given them thousands and thousands of dollars.
Of course he is.
Free
that
speech
makes
warrior.
Only the
The
most
guy who assaulted a journalist.
For asking a question.
Mm-hmm. You guys want to hear an unrelated quote from Thomas Jefferson?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter.
Interesting.
You know what goes well with those gestures?
Products.
Services also. Oh. But
and
yes,
services.
Products. Yes, you were right, Katie.
I was so excited to get one right.
You did. You got it. You nailed it.
I've won.
Would you like to throw in a free ad for something?
This
is your time. This is your time in here.
Well, right now I'm craving gummy bears, so I'd like to throw in an ad for gummy bears.
The concept of gummy bears.
Yeah, bouncing, hippity hopping, and all around the forest.
Fantastic.
Filled with juicy flavors.
Mm-hmm. Oh, juicy flavors. Gummy bears filled with juicy flavors.
I love eating candy I find in the forest.
Yeah, forest candy.
Forest candy.
It's the best kind of candy. Well, also, it's when you want it the most. Like, I imagine you hungry in the forest and you're not sure when you're going to have another snack.
You need a little sugar rush.
I was out camping with some friends years back in Texas in the summer, and we had a big bag of gummy candy, and we left it outside, and it all melted together into one giant, 4-pound, ball of it was so good. We just pour it.
Slice it up.
Pack it off. Beautiful.
Oh, fucking so tasty.
Mm. All the flavors in one.
Well, if you want all the flavors in one, buy the products. Advertised. We're back!
Whoa.
After a flawless ad pivot. Really, thank you, Katie.
Oh, you know what? You're welcome.
You're so much better at this than me.
I'm so good at this.
You are. You nailed it.
Humbly good.
Humbly good. Humbly good. So Turning Point USA doesn't just sponsor speeches and debates on college campuses to foster free speech. They also compile and maintain a professor watch list, which is definitely a thing that sounds good for free speech. As a watch list of professors. Yes. Yeah. Typical of the list is the entry for Professor Betsy Stevenson. Quote, Betsy Stevenson is an associate professor of economics at the University of Michigan. Stevenson made the list after making the claim that the lack of women found in economics textbooks is the reason so few women pursue economics as a major. In a study she conducted with Hannah Zlotnick, she found that 77% of people found in the leading economics textbooks were male. That sounds like a reason to be on a watch list.
Fire that woman.
Fire that woman for her research and speech.
Fire her.
Now, maybe it's a watch list of good researchers doing cool stuff.
That's true.
Maybe I should read the next paragraph.
Maybe you should.
Maybe I should.
I can't agree with you more.
When the watch list was originally created in November of 2016, TPUSA writer Matt Lamb described its purpose thusly. We aim to post professors who have records of targeting students for their viewpoints, forcing students to adopt a certain perspective, and or abuse or harm students in any way for standing up for their beliefs.
Okay, then.
Do you want to read your example again from earlier? My God. Sensitive little dweeb.
She claimed that women were unrepresented in economics textbooks and then proved it with rigorous data.
Well, that's threatening all the male students.
Exactly. I'm hurt.
Our future students
now.
There.
I feel attacked, and I think you should apologize to us both, Katie.
Because I'm a woman?
Exactly.
I refuse.
Wow. I'm even more offended.
I think I know a watch list you're going on.
I've always wanted to be on a watch list.
I feel the need to join Turning Point USA,
mm-hmm.
which incidentally has a history
really
of
easy
hiring
to radicalize
racists
you.
And then having to fire them.
It sure does.
Yes, it does.
I feel the need to go up to Greg Gianforte, ask him a question, and get hit in the face.
I'll leave that to you.
Yeah.
I'll get on a watch
the
list.
Freedom of speech.
We can all do TPA. Different parts of it, yeah.
We're all just different free speeches.
Cool. That Niskanen study also looked into the frequency with which college faculty members are fired due to criticism from the left and the right.
Mm.
The results are fascinating, and I'd like to quote from that study again. To begin to answer this question, I gathered together all cases from 2015 to 2017 involving, number one, a faculty member at an American degree-granting post-secondary nonprofit institution who was fired/resigned as part of a settlement or demoted denied promotion due to speech that perceived by critics as political. Okay, seems reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
What remains are 45 cases from 2015 to 2017 where a faculty member was fired, resigned, or demoted, denied promotion due to speech deemed by critics as political. Of these, more than half, 26, occurred in 2017. The clear majority, 19, being over liberal speech. This disparity persists even after removing terminations occurring in private religious institutions. For liberals, the most common types of speech to result in termination were those perceived by critics as anti-white or anti-Christian. For conservatives, they were anti-minority or anti-diversity. Now, because they're diligent, Ms. Cannon notes that the higher frequency of professors being canned for left-wing speech may have more to do with the fact that there are more left-wing professors than right-wing professors.
Sure.
That is
sure.
absolutely a factor. Mm-hmm. So, because
they're educated.
Because they're... Mm-hmm. they're let's not be mean with our facts. Facts. Our facts do care about their feelings.
Yeah. Okay. I got a D on my history paper because I'm conservative. That's why.
Yeah, my history paper was just, why was Hitler the bad guy? Right. He shouted at the people I shout at.
Yeah, I wrote a whole thing about how the Civil War was only about states' rights, and they gave me a D, and I was like, what? Is it because I voted Republican?
It's censorship.
I agree.
It's censorship because, as far as I'm aware, there was never any slavery in the South.
I learned that from my sheltered upbringing, yeah. I guess.
Well, you know, my history textbook went from the founding of humanity to 1491 and then started right back up again in 1989.
Exactly.
Somebody tore all the pages.
You get all the key parts, yeah.
Skip the nonsense.
Skip all that bullshit, yeah. Get right back into the good stuff, right into the roaring 80s. So, yeah, while there's no evidence that conservative voices are being silenced in academia, this data does not necessarily suggest that the opposite is happening. However, quote, the size of the disparity in 2017 bears watching, as it may mark the beginning of a trend in precarious liberal speech. A proper assessment would also need to take stock of the data categorization issues surrounding religious institutions where terminations for political speech are especially difficult to capture. So, like actual researchers who care about facts, even when they have a lot of data, the Niskanen people hesitate to draw conclusions that are overly broad based on the information they have because they're trying to do actual research as opposed to picking out a single issue on a single campus and saying, look at what these liberals are doing to free speech.
Well, now I don't know what to think.
Now you don't know. These seem like two equally credible people.
I mean, on the one hand, whatever dumb shit you said. On the other hand, this report. So. Yeah.
What are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
We joined TPUSA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Now, while we're on the subject of professors, we should probably talk a little bit about Cody's favorite professor.
Oh, you know
his name. Dr. Jordan fucking Peterson.
I
love
like,
your air horns.
I was waiting because as soon as you said professor watch list, I'm like, yo.
Here it comes.
Yeah, it was the only person to talk to about after this. Yeah. Now, Dr. Professor Peterson describes himself.
Jordan Balthazar Peterson.
Fucking Balthazar?
It's not Balthazar.
Bad boy Peterson.
Jordan Bad Boy Peterson.
He describes himself as, quote, a classic British liberal who defends individual freedom from collectivists. Now, he has a particular hatred for the Ontario Institute for the Studies of Education. The organization's mission statement seems mild enough, which is, you know, a little bit confusing. It says that its goal is to prepare scholars, teachers, and other professional leaders to be equipped with the skills and global awareness required by an increasingly challenging and complex society, ready to influence policy and practice in their fields. But Peterson takes issue with what I suspect is that last line, claiming the OISE is basically a training ground for dastardly social justice warriors. Sorry. In a 2017 interview with Epoch Times, he stated, the Ontario Institute for the Studies of Education, that bloody thing is a fifth column. The people who are producing the educators that emerge from that institute, they should be put on trial for treason. Like, it's serious stuff. The idea is that the purpose of education is to get them while they're young, in kindergartens, so that this radical postmodern Marxist ideology can be so thoroughly inculcated when they're young, they have no chance of escaping from it. And that's what's happening in the education system.
This paranoid maniac. They need to be tried for treason.
Robert was reading that.
Be precise in your speech.
Cody takes off his glasses and like puts his head in his hands just so everyone has the visual.
I have a, you know how when you play like an Xbox and you're playing a video game and they've got all these different like little awards you can win for doing shooting 10 people in the head or whatever. My one for this podcast is going to be giving Cody an embolism.
It's getting there. God. That quote, man, it's his entire self in one sentence.
Yeah, yeah. These people are teaching things I don't like. They should be on trial for
treason.
I love free speech.
This is like, And,
Now,
feelings.
Additionally, back in 2017, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reported that Dr. Professor Jordan Peterson planned to build a website listing university courses in Canada that had what he claimed were postmodern neo-Marxist course content. Mm-hmm. He told CTV, "We're going to start with a website in the next month and a half that will be designed to help students and parents identify postmodern content and courses so that they can avoid them."
Yeah.
Now, this created a bit of an uproar, according to the website Inside Higher Education. Quote, "In a YouTube video posted to his personal account, he highlighted English literature, anthropology, sociology, women's studies, and ethnic studies as the types of courses that, quote, that have to go. Mm-hmm. Professors at the University of Toronto expressed concern that they would be targeted by such a list, which also led to fears of harassment. Instructors of the potentially targeted courses believe that their autonomy as educators may be under threat. The proposed website has created a climate of fear and intimidation," the University of Toronto Faculty Association said in a statement to Canadian media. Now, shortly thereafter, free speech warrior Dr. Professor Jordan Peterson, Professor Doctor, announced on Twitter that he had shelved for now his plans to build a website listing courses he thought should be banned. Like women's studies.
Oh, good. I was about to ask you. You did say women's studies, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who would need to study women?
You did say anthropology, right?
Yes. Also sociology.
Oh, my God.
Also ethnic studies. Jesus. Also English literature. English literature!
Be banned? It doesn't... The fact
they
that...
They don't...
It,
should Not should be banned. Have to go.
Have to go. Okay. Let's not say banned. That would be the wrong word, banned. Mm-hmm. Have to go.
Well, sounds
to
like go. He's being censored for his
and we should be plan. Taking him seriously.
Famous censored millionaire, Dr. Professor Jordan Peterson. God.
Who only eats meat.
Who only eats meat.
Only eats beef and salt and water.
Whose poops, I'm sure, are fascinating.
Unbelievable.
Jordan, they are unbelievable poops.
Yeah, they're unfathomable poops he's got. This is the man who... had literal apocalyptic dreams about the end of the world and wanted to start a church... and believes that his wife has prophetic dreams that he is the special boy who's going to save the world from destabilization and destruction. I'm not making this up.
No.
In a different era, this man, while he is scary, would be a worldwide threat of some sort.
Yeah, it sounds a little, I don't want to say Hitler-y.
But, you know, but that's what I was going at.
Dreams of you saving the world from a...
Yes.
From destabilizing, a guy, one could say cultural Marxism. He might have a different word for it.
Yeah.
Savior syndrome type thing.
Because there's a natural order.
I think we need to spell out really directly why you and I see Nazi parallels in some of what's going on, because it is a little bit obscured. I had actually an argument with this about my dad recently.
Okay.
Because he doesn't understand, like, the... When people talk about cultural Marxism, which is a big thing for Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. He said it before.
Yeah, like, what's the exact wording he uses?
He says postmodern neo-Marxism, he talks about how they switched it and stuff like that. But there are other clips of him talking about literally cultural Marxism and stuff
like, he clearly used one term and then switched to another term. The idea of cultural Marxism comes from fucking Nazi propaganda in the 20s and 30s when they called it Kultur Bolshevismus or something like that. And the idea was both that Marxism was infiltrating society, and specifically that it was infiltrating society through the Jews who were trying to, like, undermine. This is why we see when we make snide comments about Dr. Jordan Peterson made him being kind of fascist. We're not, like, reaching super far. There was this ideology that was this attitude of cultural Marxism, that it's a thing that exists, that was created by the Nazis to justify what they did to the Jews. And then a new generation of people has just sort of cut the Jews out of cut the Judeo out of Judeo-Bolshevism. But they're like, no, there's still cultural Bolshevism.
Yes,
still
it's now like it's like the liberal academia and the left, like radical leftists and their cultural an amalgam of these groups that are doing this instead of just the Jews.
Yeah.
It's
worrisome.
Line,
yeah,
the line is very clear, and like it's one of those things where, like, no, Jordan Peterson isn't a Nazi. He would have been.
He would have been. Yeah, but it's not even. So there's that. But even beyond that, someone that says that, oh, my wife had a prophetic dream that I am this savior type person, or someone that says, you know what? Yeah. Only eating meat, that'll cure your depression.
And I want to open a church.
We need to ban women's studies, ethnic studies. That is...
Anthropology?
Anthropology!
Which is just, like, that's absolutely nuts. So that's somebody that's a maniac. I don't know how else you describe it. And if you get into power, this person gets into a power, it's terrifying.
I don't want to
oversell the state of the threat, but if Dr. Jordan Peterson gets his way, we will lose the best season of Community.
Mm-hmm.
Are we really willing to.
No, absolutely not.
No, we fucking aren't.
No.
But
it's a good show.
It's a great show. Yeah.
Ended on a high note.
Really? Yeah, that was actually really.
Except
really
Donald Glover's gone, but
yeah, that was sad. But they really did a good job.
But now you got.
Oh yeah, no. Both of the actors they brought in for the six seasons.
Six seasons are amazing.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah.
Writing is perfect. It's good. It's
really, really, yeah, nice note. Cheers me up a little bit every time. We've gotten well off of track here. Now, let's talk about free speech warrior Dr. Jordan Peterson, who is a big fan of free speech. Mm-hmm. Big fan of free speech.
Clearly.
Huge lover of free speech. In June of 2019, the doctor professor was invited to speak at the Brain Bar in Budapest by Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Mr. Orban wanted to speak with the doctor professor about current political issues. According to New York Magazine, quote, the Orban-friendly news outlet Hungary Today described their meeting as an amiable conversation about the dangers of illegal immigration, political correctness, and Jean-Claude Juncker's apologias for Karl Marx. Peterson and Orban also touched on a current tendency to minimize the crimes committed under communist regimes. They cited an infamous speech by European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker in which they said he defended Karl Marx. Now, if you lean a little bit more towards the conservative end of the spectrum, and you have not kept a pace with Hungarian politics, you may not immediately see what's so fucked up about this. Viktor Orban is an avowed advocate of what he calls illiberal democracy, a.k.a. not really democracy at all.
Yeah. Illiberal.
Illiberal. In his 2018 acceptance speech, he declared an end to the era of liberal democracy. We have replaced a shipwrecked liberal democracy with a 21st century Christian democracy, which guarantees people's freedom, security. It supports the traditional family model of one man and one woman, keeps anti-Semitism at bay, and gives a chance for growth. Free speech lover Viktor Orban.
Yeah.
Now, after his election, he passed a series of punitive laws and launched a propaganda campaign that forced the Central European University to withdraw from his country. New York Magazine describes them as a liberal institution whose avowed purpose was to protect the open society from authoritarianism of the right or left. They also note that, at the nation's remaining colleges, Orban has banned fields of study that conflict with the state's conception of truth. And while Orban identifies as a liberal Democrat, his party has insulated its power against the threat of popular rebuke to such a degree that many scholars describe his regime as a creeping dictatorship.
Cool.
Now, in a 2018 interview, Dr. Peterson himself agreed that Hungary's assaults on academic freedom were unacceptable. Yet he agreed to sit down with Orban and have a convivial talk about the danger of cultural Marxism. Meanwhile, Peterson decried the idea that people ought to accept different gender pronouns for trans and non-binary people as being dangerously in line with, quote, the Marxist doctrines that killed at least 100 million people in the 20th century.
What? What?
Dr. Professor Jordan Peterson there.
Expert on
the world.
It's so interesting to hear him talk about this stuff. And it's like one of those things where, like, you don't hear him talk about the other side of this, the people that die from
fascism,
the extension of sort of what he espouses.
Of course
you
not.
Don't
It's just interesting.
It's only communism has killed people.
He doesn't feel compelled to talk about that. It's his right.
It's his
right. As a free speech warrior.
As a free speech warrior.
Point of order. Jordan B. Peterson, who's a clinical psychologist.
Dr. Professor Jordan B. Peterson,
clinical psychologist, has on more than one occasion on camera claimed to be an evolutionary biologist and a neuroscientist. Two things he is not. Two things that a respectable, say, professor or doctor wouldn't claim to be if they were not. Mm-hmm. It seems like perhaps he's...
addled.
Dishonest.
Dishonest, okay.
That might be possible.
Also, he's once asked if he supported gay marriage that cultural Marxists are supporting, and he's like, well, if cultural Marxists support it, I wouldn't support it. So.
Oh, cool.
Very cool.
That's a solid intellectual line to take.
Mm-hmm.
Now, earlier in this episode, when we started talking about the good doctor, I noted that he identifies personally as a classic British liberal. You probably heard that, Kate, Cody.
Yeah.
Now, this is not an uncommon statement from intellectual figures on the right. Many of them identify as classical liberals. Mm-hmm. When they do so, they are putting themselves in line with an intellectual tradition that is descended in large part from a 19th century philosopher and British member of parliament named John Stuart Mill. In his influential essay On Liberty, Mill wrote this. There ought to exist the fullest liberty of professing and discussing as a matter of ethical conviction any doctrine, however immoral it may be considered. If all mankind minus one were of one opinion and only one person were of the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he, if he had the power, would be justified in silencing mankind. Mm. Now, When classical liberals like Peterson talk about free speech, they are calling upon the ideas they inherited from Mill, or at least the ideas they believe they inherited from Mill. I found a great article about this on The Conversation titled The Strange Origins of Free Speech Warriors. Quote, in truth, thinkers such as Mill were far from being libertarians, and what's more, would never have embraced the borderline absolutist position of today's free speech warriors. Based in what is called the harm principle, Mill argued for a big government approach to situations in which the exercise of liberty might result in harm to others or even to the individual practicing it. In On Liberty, he argues that parents of poor moral fiber may have their children removed from the home and calls for similar state intervention to stop the harms caused by gamblers, prostitutes, and the drug addicts. Even more broadly, he decides that the uncultivated cannot be competent judges of cultivation. Those who most need to be made wiser and better usually desire it least, and if they desire it, would be incapable of finding the way to it by their own lights.
They've got to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I'd be a little bit remiss in talking about the harm principle without getting into a little bit of the history of U.S. jurisprudence as it relates to free speech cases. In March of 1919, which is about 100 years ago, wow. Oliver Wendell
time
Holmes.
Time flies, guys.
Time does fly. Oliver Wendell Holmes, oh, homie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Classic.
Yeah. Wynn Holmesy. Oh, Windy. All good nicknames.
Oh, Whimsy? Is that what
you... Whimsy? That's a good nickname. Yeah. Oh, Whimsy, Supreme Court Justice, wrote a series of unanimous opinions on three cases upholding the convictions and prison sentences of members of the Socialist Party. These people's crime had been writing and distributing some 15,000 flyers to men who were in the process of being conscripted. The flyers argued that conscription was involuntary servitude and prohibited by the 13th Amendment. Also involved were the court cases of Eugene Debs, a socialist presidential candidate who protested against World War I in a speech. Debs and his comrades were found to have violated the Espionage and Sedition Acts. In justifying their incarceration, Holmes wrote, words which, ordinarily and in many cases, would be within the freedom of speech protected by the First Amendment, may become subject to prohibition when of such nature and used in such circumstances as to create a clear and present danger that they will be bring about the substantive evils of which Congress has a right to prevent.
Free speech.
Free speech.
Sounds kind of Peterson-y.
Sounds a little bit Peterson-y. Now, Holmes went on to write a line that has since become famous. The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. That's where that comes from. Mm-hmm. I'm going to quote next from an article in the LA Review of Books by Stephen Rode about sort of where all this ends after we jail all these socialists for free speech that's too dangerous to be allowed. Only 8 months later, in November 1919, joined by his protege Justice Brandeis in the case Abrams v. United States, Holmes would signal a dramatic and pivotal shift in his approach to the First Amendment. As recounted in the illuminating essay, Right Skepticism and Majority Rule at the Birth of the Modern First Amendment by Vincent Blasi, Corliss Lamont Professor of Civil Liberties at Columbia Law School, which explains why the year 1919 deserves to inaugurate the free speech century, Holmes' dissent planted the fertile seeds of our modern-day First Amendment jurisprudence. Holmes declared that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, that the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market, and that the truth is the only ground upon which their wishes safely can be carried out. He saw the Constitution as an experiment, as all life is an experiment, but he warned that we should be eternally vigilant against attempts to check the expression of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death unless they so immediately threaten interference with the lawful and pressing purposes of the law that an immediate check is required to save the country. Okay. This is what he does 8 months after, you know, agreeing that those socialists ought to be jailed for saying that drafting people is kind of like slavery. Now, Holmes's views, his new views that he shifted to after jailing the socialists.
Quick, a quick shift.
Yeah, yeah. Turnaround.
They would be codified in American law 50 years later during the 1969 Brandenburg v. Ohio case. In another unanimous decision, the Supreme Court overturned the conviction of a KKK leader who had led a rally of armed men. These Klansmen had burnt crosses and talked about taking revenge against the N-words and Jews that claimed that the U.S. government continues to suppress the white Caucasian race. They announced plans for the 4th of July march on Washington, D.C. In his per curiam opinion for the court, Justice William Brennan wrote, the constitutional guarantees of free speech and free press do not permit a state to forbid or prescribe advocacy of the use of force or of law violation except where an advocacy is directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. It's interesting to me, when we talk about the history of the evolution of free speech in this country, that when socialists told draftees that being conscripted violated their human rights, that speech was too dangerous to be protected. But when white supremacists carried guns and promised to take vengeance on black people and Jews, the Supreme Court decided that's explicitly protected as long as they don't say that vengeance should occur on this exact day.
I would say it's unbelievable, but it isn't.
This law's neat, right?
Yeah, man. So the people threatening lives are fine.
This adds up to me.
Don't add, but if you don't say a date.
If I don't say a date.
If you don't say a date.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Just
oh,
say,
oh, okay.
We should take revenge against the Jews. But don't say, we should take revenge against the Jews on July 15th. Okay. That's where you're going to jail.
Sticky, sticky
so as long
waters.
As it's not like an organized flash mob type situation, then, yeah.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Cool. You know what else is cool? It is probably.
Services? Wait, services too?
Oh, yeah. There's going to be a service or two.
I got both.
Oh, boy. I hope it's a dick pill ad. We really could use some dick pills. Hims. Great dick pills.
Hims?
Did you hear about that? There's a new drug being developed
for women
to make women aroused.
Yeah.
And, like, that seems like.
Incredibly.
It seems like a
complicated.
Seems like a,
morally.
Seems like a dangerous kind of drug to make available to just like
to women.
I think it's a dangerous drug to make available to men.
That's what I'm getting at.
I have no issue with women taking a whatever drug.
All for women taking control of that.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about men getting a hold of that drug.
Yes, I hear you.
But you know what I'm not concerned with?
Services and products.
I was going to say just erection drugs in general.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because I don't know if you guys know this, but the climate is collapsing and sex is zero emissions.
Sex is on the rise.
It's on the rise. It's good. It's good to have. And
have some.
With all these horrible facts we read, sometimes it's hard to get an erection. So,
Well, you guys
pills.
Should be worried about women slipping your dick pills into drinks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hear that.
Yeah. The one thing
I don't know where to go from here.
I ruined it.
It's probably going to be a Microsoft ad after this anyway. Which
ooh, perfect. Oh yeah.
Talk about a dick pill.
One way or the other, buy some dick pills.
Mm-hmm.
That was a free ad.
Don't
I just
be
gave them.
Microsoft.
Well,
be macro hard.
So good. That was so good.
I think we get like twice as much ad money from that one.
We get millions of dollars.
That was a high score. Mm-hmm.
Millions of dollars. We'll be like Dr. Jordan Peterson. I'm going to tell people to only eat meat.
Oh, I do not want to be like him.
No. All right. Go hear some ads. We're back from our increasing digression.
My wife thinks I'm Jesus.
Cody's pretending to be Dr. Jordan Peterson again.
Peter Prince.
I've never done it out loud. I'm working on it.
Sorry. He's working on it. He's doing it, getting his tight five for Peterson set. Then with the Comedy Cellar. Mm-hmm. Now, we just talked a little bit about the origins of free speech law and how it's evolved over the last century.
Yeah. How maybe it's enforced on one side, not so much on the other side.
Maybe it's not.
It's sort of forgiven when it's really extreme. And then,
Yeah. Maybe that's a little
when
bit.
When it's related to human rights, it's sort of like,
fuck it.
It's like, look the other way.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the organized and well-funded campaign to make sure freedom of speech continues to evolve in a very specific direction.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom of speech law, I should say.
Yeah,
The concept itself. Although, that too. Have y'all ever heard of Brett Weinstein?
Sure have.
Mm.
Oh, good!
I was going to bring him up earlier, and here we are.
All right. He was a biology professor at Evergreen State College who went viral online for opposing a protest that asked white students and faculty to stay home as part of a symbolic protest against white supremacy. Now, he was not fired for this, but he was criticized for his actions, so he resigned, sued the school, and got a bunch of money in a settlement, and then did the rounds talking to Ben Shapiro, Joe Rogan, David Rubin, and the other icons of what is now called the intellectual dark web. Now, another member of the intellectual dark web and a guest on literally all of those same podcasts is a guy named Jonathan Haidt, co-author of the Atlantic article, The Coddling of the American Mind.
Oh, yeah.
You know
perfect.
What I'm building to right now?
I feel like probably, yeah.
I'm thinking right now.
Let's do your thing. Let's do it.
I like using this voice with you.
Yeah,
it's exciting.
Yeah.
We can do a whole episode like this of our election podcast.
I'm going to talk like this to balance it out. Like,
we'll get you some Thorazine. We'll get Cody and I. What kind of drug makes your voice high? Helium.
Helium.
Helium and Thorazine day.
God.
That's how we do the Autism One conference episode.
Okay.
nailing it.
Yeah, yeah,
helium
yeah.
and Thorazine.
We're making plans,
folks. This is going to be a great podcast. Let's continue the podcast that we're already
the current one, yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Now, the intellectual dark web itself was first coined and defined by Barry Weiss, staff mm-hmm. editor of the New York Times opinion section. Mm-hmm. She has also been a guest on Joe Rogan's mm-hmm. podcast. Mm-hmm. Now, we noted earlier that the claims of that Coddling of the American Mind article don't hold up to evidence. Mm. 4 years of college, of course, makes people less supportive of banning any kind of free speech, and young people are more tolerant of offensive speech than older Americans. No matter what academic free speech grifters like Weinstein may claim, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education found that in 2018, there were a grand total of 18 disinvitation attempts across all colleges and universities in the United States. Not all of those succeeded. Given that young people are more likely to tolerate offensive speech and that college students are less likely to support free speech restrictions than the general population, one is left wondering what all this hubbub arose from. It may have something to do with the fact that Generation Z, or the I generation, is further to the left than any other group in this country. 70% of them believe the government should be more involved in problem solving. 62% say racial and ethnic diversity is good for society, compared to 49 and 48% of baby boomers, respectively.
That's a good stat.
That's a jump.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, Generation Z also prefers socialism to capitalism by a marked majority. Mm-hmm. And this, you might expect, is terrifying to several small but influential groups in our country. And when I say small, I mean like two guys. The Koch brothers.
Yes.
Yeah, here we go,
that
baby.
That is where it was going. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to quote next from a fantastic article in The American Prospect by Aaron Friedman, which inspired this episode. Quote, Dave Rubin's influential podcast, The Rubin Report, has a financial partnership with Learn Liberty, a think tank started by the Koch-funded Institute for Humane Studies, IHS, where Charles G. Koch himself sits on the board. When the Canadian government denied Jordan Peterson funding for his work, Rebel Media, a group funded with Koch money and headed by Ezra Levant, a far-right Islamophobe with ties to the Koch network, raised cash for him. Peterson has since returned the favor, fundraising for the IHS. Ben Shapiro has collected speaker fees from the Koch-funded Young Americans Foundation and Turning Point USA, and Brett Weinstein was hosted by the University of Wisconsin-Stout's Free Speech Week, a project of their Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovations, funded by, you guessed it, the Charles G. Koch Foundation. It's not just the IDW itself. Some of its key popularizers also get Koch funding. Barry Weiss and The Atlantic's Connor Friesendorf, who has been one of the most visible defenders of Peterson in the mainstream media, have both received cash prizes from the Koch-funded Reason Foundation, where David Koch himself sits on the Board of Trustees. And remember the coddling of the American mind? Well, one of its co-authors, Greg Lukianoff, is the head of that campus free speech watchdog, FIRE. That organization is funded, of course, by the Koch brothers. For good measure, the Charles Koch Institute also did a laudatory write-up of the piece.
Did you mention the Daily Caller?
Not yet.
Okay.
Oh, no. The Daily, yeah.
They also donate to there.
Yeah. The Atlantic is perhaps the worst offender. Last year it launched The Speech Wars, a reporting project that seeks to understand where free speech is in danger and where it has been abused. Even though the magazine had just been bought by billionaire Lorraine Powell Jobs and was seeing all-time high circulation web traffic, The Atlantic solicited funding for the project from none other and the Charles Koch Foundation. Mm-hmm. The Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and the Fetzer Institute were also underwriters. When I asked The Atlantic for comment, a spokesperson replied that the editorial control for the series, as with every piece of journalism we create, rests solely with The Atlantic. But the magazine refused to deny that reporters and editors with The Speech Wars are ever in contact with the Koch Foundation. Editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg did not respond to my request for comment, and The Atlantic has not disclosed how much money it has received from the Koch Foundation.
That's actually pretty surprising for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. The first half, I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, what?
I know.
What?
And then
excuse
I...
me? Mm-hmm. That just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
Wowee.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Ties it all together.
Man, they're terrified.
Yeah.
They
are scaredy young folks.
They are. I mean, they're like really going forward with funding a lot of like centrists for the, mm-hmm. and like...
Yeah, they are fucking like, terrified really losing, scared. Of literally losing like 2-4% of their wealth.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Richard Fink, president of the Charles G. Koch Charitable Foundation, has explained this whole strategy in talking about his structure of social change philosophy. The basic idea is to spend Koch money in strategic ways to influence broad social change. Fink believes college campuses are one of the most important places to spend money in order to institute changes, and that's why all this is happening. The Kochs and their billionaire friends who help fund their foundation directly to fund the free speech grifters, because they see what's coming, a generation who wants to take their money and use it for such vile ends as clean water in American cities, roads, and basic health care. They aren't scared on behalf of free speech. They're scared on behalf of their bank accounts.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it right there.
Yeah.
It reminded me, you know, the Daily Beast is obviously very liberal.
Yeah, I know it's say so.
The thing. Half the time, not half the time, but every so often you go on there and they've got an article, an ad masquerading as an article mm-hmm. by the Koch brothers. Mm-hmm. They're like, the Koch brothers plan to make to save the world. I think that's actually the headline one of them was. The Koch brothers plan to save the world. Brought to you by the Koch brothers. The
Chelsea Koch Foundation.
Very upset.
Who may be advertising on this episode, actually. Like, you may, there's a chance. A non-zero chance. Yeah.
It's always so obvious and interesting and keeps going and going. The amount of projection from these people.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the free speech thing and the censorship on campus is the opposite, as we've discussed. But then, like, you have all these people who really go hard in on, like, George Soros is using his billions of dollars mm-hmm. to, like, all that kind of stuff. But wait.
That's what.
But everyone who's saying that is funded by these.
You're showing your cards, man.
Koch brothers. Like,
how did you get that idea in your head? From your personal experience?
And, like, also, like, just even if you take it on face value, like, well, who's. Like, what's the purpose? One is, like, for humanitarian reasons, and one is to protect their money?
Yeah. It makes me crazy that this age we live in is, like, not me, you. Nuh-uh, you.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. It's very frustrating.
It's very frustrating.
Very frustrating. I love that the media is constantly attacked for being liberal and left-leaning, but even very liberal sites will regularly host op-eds about how the Koch brothers are great and libertarianism is good and limits on emissions are bad. But you know what you're not going to fucking see on The Atlantic? You know what you're not going to fucking see in The Daily Beast? It's like an article on why workers should control the means of production.
No, you're not. I mean, the framing of like the far left media is just so frustrating.
Yeah. No, what do you have the far left? I haven't seen an article about how profits are theft from workers.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that in a while. I haven't seen anybody.
Same thing with
also,
like,
the media. Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's a bias against Trump and everything. Mm-hmm. But even at that, even talking about stuff, they're so concerned with not appearing biased that they, you know, oftentimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the fucking these people who call themselves fucking journalists. And I want to just punch in the face for even using that word, who like say, look, it may be accurate to call them concentration camps, but like it really offends people. And in order to have a productive conversation, we should like that's not journalism.
Nope.
Bro-meme.
No, like, that's not how it works.
Journalism is looking outside and being like, oh, hey, it's raining. Mm. Oh, hey, there's a concentration camp. Look at it.
Raining.
That's a concentration camp.
Well, if you say
let me
it's
describe
rain,
what I see
hurt,
at this concentration camp.
It's going to hurt the feelings of all the dry people.
Yeah.
So.
Make people jealous.
Hashtag dry pride.
I didn't realize Barry Weiss was also funded by the Koch brothers.
Yeah, yep. That was a surprise, too.
That's a real.
Real cool. I didn't realize The Atlantic got Koch money either.
Didn't realize that either.
That's
I mean,
really
they've got
disappointing.
So much
yeah. Yep. Very disappointing.
That's wild.
This is probably torpedoed my chances to write an op-ed for The Atlantic.
I don't know.
You'll be okay.
Okay.
You'll be all right.
Just give him some ad money.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll give him some ad money for my dick pills.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Just like even separate from a company, just of the concept of pills that give people erections.
Yeah, just
that's
be like,
what
hey,
advertise.
What about that? It's just like, what about pills for your dick?
Mm-hmm. And then I'll sneak in a line about how if you pay attention to the way the economy works, whenever wages rise, the stock market falls because it's fundamentally outside of the interests of the capital holding classes for workers to make more money because that money that goes to them in wages does not go to the stockholding class in profits. And as a result, the people who actually own stocks have diametrically opposed interests to everyone listening to this podcast. Dick pills! Yeah! Penises! They're fun!
I love whenever that happens. Like, oh, the stock market's on the rise. Like,
so?
What?
How many stocks you got, bro?
Right, like, why like, should any of these people give a shit? Like,
if I know you, like, you probably have enough money for rent and a couple of six packs.
Yeah.
And like,
probably not going to.
If you have
you
a 401k, you got it the way I did, which is not knowing you had a 401k
right.
when you had that job. And you're like, oh, okay.
thank you. Thank you for this thing. I didn't understand.
Cool.
Yeah. Anyway, that's the episode.
That was a great episode. Frustrating, all the things that are
mm-hmm.
yeah.
to be expected.
Glad I stopped myself from going on
All right.
Various tirades.
I'm going to do a dangerous thing, and then I'm going to have you guys plug your way out. I've got the the half-smashed LaCroix bottle, and I got my machete, and I'm going to try to hit it into the sounding boards as if I am batting a tennis ball. Okay. I don't know what kind of ball you bat this way, but that's what I'm going to do now for this audio-only podcast. Yeah! I made it a decent distance. Didn't hit the sounding boards.
Got close.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Good time.
You could do it again if you practice.
You guys want to plug your pluggables?
Yeah, you know, check us out. We have a podcast called Even More News and also a YouTube show
called Some More News.
That's correct. My name's Katie Stoll. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Stoll.
My name is Cody Johnston. You can find me on Twitter at Dr. Mr. Cody.
My name is Katie Johnston and Robert Evans. And actually, you can find me at the internet. Sophie's not here. I am not doing well.
You're doing great.
Thank you.
Don't worry about it.
She's here in spirit.
BehindTheBastards.com is our podcast where you can find all the sources for this episode. You can also find us on tpublic.com where you can buy shirts and cups, and that will make someone's stock market price.
Someone's stock. Probably. Oh, yeah.
Some stock will go, even if it's fucking cotton stocks anyway, and then everything will be better, as I understand the stock market. You can find me on Twitter at IWriteOkay. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @BastardsPod. That's the fucking episode. Mm-hmm. Go home or riot in the streets. One of the two.
Goodbye.
Patreon.com/
Oh, yeah.
For stock.
Oh, yeah, for stock. That's the kind of stock I can get behind.
Exactly.
Stock.